They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society. Hi, this is Nate Kaczmarek for the Article 1 Initiative. Welcome again to the Necessary and Proper podcast. On August 22nd, the initiative was pleased to partner once more with the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group to host a teleform discussion with Federal Society members on improving regulation, process versus substance. This discussion brought together J. Kennerly Davis, Jr., who is a senior attorney and former Deputy Attorney General for the state of Virginia, and Professor Tom Lambert, Wall Chair in Corporate Law and Governance and Professor of Law at the University of Missouri School of Law. Over the last several months, these two legal experts have been debating Professor Lambert's 2017 book, How to Regulate, A Guide for Policymakers. And this conversation provides an interesting take on their different approaches to regulatory reform. Thanks for listening, and please remember to send us your feedback at articlei@fedsoc.org.
This teleforum came to be because I wrote a book, and then Ken wrote a review of the book, and I wrote a response to his review. And if you're interested, the review that Ken wrote is in the Federal Society review from maybe May, I believe, and then my response is on the blog truthonthemarket.com. I think that Ken and I agree that the regulatory state is somewhat out of control, but in the course of all this back and forth over my book, it became apparent that we have different perspectives on how best to improve regulation and rein in the administrative state. I think we might be able to label these approaches, our different approaches, an either-or approach or a both-and approach. So to tee up the issue, maybe the best way to start is to tell you a little bit about my book. The book has the very titillating title, How to Regulate, A Guide for Policymakers. It's a Cambridge Press book from 2017, and it's available on Amazon, and it makes great gifts. The focus of the book is really on the substance of regulation. Now, I was motivated to write this book because I've been a law professor in a flagship state law school for about 15 years. I have seen over that time that a number of my students go on to be regulators, largely at the state level, or they take policymaking jobs. I mean, a lot of them, a surprising percentage of them go into these jobs. It occurred to me, you know, we really don't teach in law school the substance of regulation. Now, we teach administrative law, and of course, everybody on this call is quite familiar with administrative law, but the focus of a law school administrative law course is really on process. What process must you follow? What hoops must you jump through to ensure that your rule has the force of law? We also teach classes, often called leg-reg classes, legislation regulation classes. Those courses usually focus on interpretation of legal directives. It's rare that we teach students, you know, if you're going to craft a regulatory approach to address some new problem in the world, what should the approach look like? What should be your goal? What are the tools in your toolkit? What works well when? When do the various, or what are the downsides of the various tools? So if you think about it, you know, for just about every market failure, there are multiple ways to address that market failure. With information asymmetry, sometimes we engage in licensing. Sometimes we have mandatory disclosure. You know, with externalities, sometimes we have a command and control system. An alternative would be Pigouvian taxes. A third alternative would be some sort of cap and trade system. There are different tools that could be used to address each of these market failures, and some work better in some contexts than others. So the goal of my book was to sort of lay all of that out. The book is organized around the model of a physician. You know, when a person goes to see a physician, he comes in with symptoms, and the physician doesn't necessarily just immediately treat the symptom. You know, you've got fever, here's some fever-reducing pills. You know, go on your way. I think that often when we regulate, that's how we regulate. There's a problem that we don't like in the world, and so the policy response is to ban the outcome that we don't like. And that's not a very sensible way to do things. So the analogy that I use in the book is the physician analogy. When you go to see a physician, she'll first assess your symptoms, and then she diagnoses the disease. What is it that's causing these symptoms to occur? When she's diagnosed the disease, then she'll consider sort of the range of remedies for that disease. You know, these remedies vary in terms of intrusiveness and effectiveness and cost, but she'll lay out the various remedies. Then she considers the side effects of each of the remedies and ultimately selects the remedy that offers the highest net benefit for the patient. So that is what I sort of did in the book. The book, I set out that model at the beginning, and then there are six primary chapters of the book. One deals with externalities, second on public goods, agency costs, market power, information asymmetry. And then there's a final chapter on the cognitive and volitional limitations that behavioral economists purport to have discovered. So for each of these six main chapters, the chapter's organized according to that physician analogy, sort of what symptom do we see here? Then disease, why is it that the symptom is occurring? And that, of course, is a lot of economic, playing microeconomics. Then we move to the range of remedies. What are the different things that could be done to address this particular market failure? And then finally, what are the side effects of each of these? Now, a key theme of my book is that a market failure is a necessary, but never a sufficient condition for regulation. We always have to ask, can the government improve upon private ordering? Now, the book is very careful to point out that just as markets can fail in systematic ways, government fails in systematic ways. So two government failures that come up over and over throughout the book are, first of all, you know, what economists would call the Hayekian knowledge problem. F.A. Hayek famously observed in this article, The Use of Knowledge in Society, that central economic planning is destined to fail because the planners don't have all the time and space specific information they need in order to allocate resources efficiently. And if you think about it, regulation is really some form of central planning. So there's always a knowledge requirement on the part of the regulator or the policymaker. And if the policymaker doesn't have the information he needs, resources can be misallocated. That's always a problem. A second systematic government failure is what I call in the book public choice concerns. The body of economics referred to as public choice, of course, takes the rational choice model of human behavior, people are rational self-interest maximizers, and observes that people retain that fundamental nature when they go into the government. So, you know, government officials are rational self-interest maximizers. That means that quite often when they make decisions, regulatory decisions, they're not necessarily doing what's best for the public, but instead they're maybe doing what's best for themselves. And that can lead to all sorts of misuses of the regulatory system to get private benefit, sometimes for private businesses, sometimes for regulators, et cetera. Now, those two maladies, the knowledge problem and public choice concerns, exist in different degrees for different types of regulatory approaches. And generally, the more restrictive a regulatory approach is, the greater the knowledge problem and the greater public choice concerns there are. So what I typically do in each of these chapters is sort of lay out the remedies that are available for each of the market failures on a spectrum of restrictiveness, and then sort of consider how the knowledge problem and public choice concerns play out. Now, it's important for me to note here that when I talk about regulation, I don't necessarily mean a rule that's promulgated by an agency. You know, we lawyers typically draw a distinction between a regulation and a statute. I don't necessarily mean that. I'm using more of an economic definition of regulation. So when I say regulation, I mean any force-backed directive that's aimed at correcting some sort of market failure. And that directive could come directly from a legislature. So you could have a statute that I would call a regulation because it's a forced back directive intended to correct a market failure, but there's no agency involved. You could have a doctrine that was crafted by a court. Many of the antitrust prohibitions are really court created, but they're regulatory in nature in the sense that they're trying to deal with the market failure of market power. So what I've tried to provide in this book is a framework for crafting regulatory approaches that minimizes the sum of losses from market failure on the one hand and from government failure on the other. What I haven't done is specify which particular governmental entity should craft the rules. So I haven't said that expert agencies should craft the rules, or that Congress should do so, or that courts should do so. I've instead focused on the substance of regulatory approaches. And I did that largely because lots of other folks have talked extensively about, you know, institutional structure. My focus was not really on that. It was really more on what's the end product that we would like to see from whatever structure is in place. I think that my ideas are consistent with efforts to constrain independent and executive branch agencies. I think you could be a committed constitutionalist that thinks, you know, independent agencies are unconstitutional and you want to blow them all up and whatnot, and still find my ideas useful, because they're going to be replaced with something else that crafts rules. And my book is really about what the substance of the rules should look like. So, in sum, I don't think we are forced to pursue an either-or approach. Either fix the substance of regulation or pursue structural reform. Instead, I think we should pursue a both-and approach, where we work to educate policymakers on what constitutes good regulation as a substantive matter, and we seek to bring our regulatory system into conformity with the governmental structure specified in the Constitution. And with that, I will turn things over to Ken and let him explain why I'm wrong.
Thank you. And first, let me add my thanks, in fact, to the Federalist Society for organizing this teleforum, and to Tom Lambert for agreeing to participate with me and the rest of us this afternoon. And as Micah notes, the views expressed by both of us certainly may reflect only my personal opinions. As Tom noted, this process or this teleforum today is actually a culmination of a process that began my having an opportunity through the society to review his book. And I must take the opportunity to strongly recommend to everybody on this call and anybody you might speak to strongly recommend Tom Lambert's book. It is a thorough, comprehensive, clearly written discussion of regulation and how the whole system and process might be improved, reformed to be made better and result in better regulation. I think the book would be of particular use to lawyers who feel they're a little short because of their misdirected undergraduate studies, a little short of economics. Again, this is a substantive and complete treatment of a lot of important, fundamentally important economic principles and theories. It is, the book and this discussion is about regulatory reform and how to make things better. It's a very important topic. Reform means more than rollbacks and rescissions. It is focused on and involves attempts to identify structural and procedural changes that are more lasting in their nature. And reform is also, whether it's regulatory reform or any kind of form, is really a quintessentially American undertaking. I mean, we are a magnificent people. We are strivers, inventors, implementers, explorers, always trying to make things better in one way or another. But as we strive to make regulation better, and think about regulation and regulatory reform, I think it's very, very important to have in the back of our minds and in every discussion the understanding that better is, of course, a relative term, and it implies, in fact, it requires some sort of comparison between the current situation and an alternative, and those two states or alternatives measured against some standard, some ideal, some goal that we want to reach. And it's the standard for comparison that I think defines the kind of basis of the different approaches to regulatory reform that Tom and I take. One approach, and of course, I'm running the risk of oversimplification here, but one approach would be to look at the current system, the current administrative and regulatory system, and try to think of incremental or particular adjustments to the current system that would enable it to run more effectively or more efficiently, to function, in that sense, to function better. But if you look at the current system generally, and it might be called the regulatory system or the administrative state, and you're concerned about the extent to which it fundamentally departs from the constitutional system established by our founders, then you've got to ask yourself whether there's a risk in making, in trying to identify particular incremental steps to make the current system run better, more effectively, whether you're, by doing that, you're strengthening a system that has fundamental problems that should be addressed on a more fundamental basis. A few years back, Philip Hamburger wrote a book that took as its title, The Rhetorical Question, Is the Administrative State Unlawful? And he, at considerable and impressive length and detail, answered that question in the affirmative, reviewing the many ways, discussing and describing and explaining the many ways in which the current administrative system and administrative state is inconsistent with and contrary to the constitutional system that developed in England and the concepts of restraint, of arbitrary and discretionary executive power, that system and how it's been undermined and weakened and by the development of the administrative state over the last 100 years. So if you have those concerns, and I certainly do, then you want to take a more fundamentalist, if you will, approach to the reforms that you would try to advance. Now, there are pluses and minuses or risks and potential rewards involved in either approach. What I'm calling, again, as an oversimplification, the incremental approach or the fundamental approach. With the incremental approach, you may entrench a system that is fundamentally flawed, but with the fundamental reform approach, you may devote your time and efforts to reforms that, because they are so far-reaching and fundamental, stand a very small chance of enactment, and by the devotion of that time and effort, you may miss the opportunity to make an improvement in the current system that is incremental, but it's better than no improvement at all. But I do advocate for the more fundamental reforms that would focus on the differences between the current system with its consolidated powers and limited accountability, and would take the measure of the current system by comparing its features to the constitutional system as established by the powers, by the founders, with its separation of powers and the confinement of legislative activity in the branch peopled by elected representatives, and the executive branch being focused on execution and administration, and the judicial branch on the resolution of disputes. There's a wonderful description of the of our historic constitutional system with its separation of powers, written by now Justice Gorsuch in his concurring opinion in the Gutierrez case that was published in August 2016. But the structure, the constitutional structure of our founding was consciously erected to limit the arbitrary exercise, the discretionary exercise of executive power. The founders and colonists and then founders had had a great deal of unpleasant experience with discretionary and arbitrary executive power as exercised by the king, and they sought to limit that and to secure the natural rights of each and every individual and their individual liberty, the natural rights affirmed in the second paragraph of the Declaration. So much of what concerns people, I think, about the current system, the consolidation of once separate functions within a largely accountable executive branch or fourth branch, the constantly changing rules, the rules written to pick winners and losers, the endless maze of permitting, overbearing administration, politicized enforcement, retroactivity, waivers, and overall, the abiding uncertainty that results from the broadly defined discretionary authority of individual regulators. All of this is directly traceable to the unconstitutional, the, if you will, the lawlessness of the current regulatory system. The essence of the rule of law is the restraint of arbitrary power, whereas the essence of the current regulatory system is the exercise of arbitrary and discretionary power, the rule of law displaced by the rule of the regulator. And so as we seek to restore a constitutional structure, I think part of that exercise involves appropriately a focus on the kind of embedded underlying important assumptions and concepts that define the administrative state and its operation. That is beyond the consolidation of power. I mean, Tom Lambert referred to market failure and policymakers, or might call them experts, and the overall aim to increase social welfare through regulation. I am very skeptical and critical of each of those concepts. I think they're contra-constitutional and invalid and don't justify the exercise of power as we have seen it exercised by regulators. But perhaps we could come back to that. Let me pause and ask Tom if he'd like to respond to any of the things I've said thus far.
Sure. And thank you, Ken. I want to thank Ken for reviewing the book. It really is a huge amount of work to review a book. And I very much appreciate his doing that and his willingness to talk today. So, you know, there are a couple of things that I think people could criticize about my approach. So I could get criticisms from people that are really kind of hardcore Hayekians. Hayek drew this distinction between law and legislation. And he said, you know, law is discovered and it's emergent. And, you know, the common law is something that develops over time tends to be highly efficient, purpose independent. And then you have legislation that's designed by people, and it can be, it has knowledge problem issues, and it can be manipulated by private interests and whatnot. And regulation that I'm talking about is, would be legislation in Hayek's view. So Hayekians might say, you know, we should get out of this business altogether. And my response to that is essentially, I think the ship has sailed. I think that we're going to have designed legislation that's designed to correct market failure, so we might as well do it sensibly. It sounds like Ken's response is not exactly that. Instead, it's more of a sort of constitutional conservative response that says, look, when you talk about substantively good regulation, you use terms like market failure, correcting market failure, enhancing social welfare. You have policymakers that make choices about how best to do that. Those are all sort of progressive concepts that, if you endorse at all, strengthens the administrative state. I think that's Ken's point. And so I guess I would respond as follows, and this is going to be a response to each of the three concepts that Ken is troubled by. One is the concept of market failure. You know, I think that conservatives and libertarians need to get comfortable talking about market failure. The vast majority of economists believe that markets sometimes fail. And believe me, I think markets are amazing and work well the vast majority of the time. But when the stars align, we can see market failures. So I think we lose credibility if we pretend that those market failures don't exist. Now, it's very important for us to emphasize, and this is a key thing in my book, that market failure is not a sufficient condition for a regulatory fix. It's necessary but insufficient. We've got to look at the way that government systematically fails. But I think that we lose credibility when we pretend that markets don't fail. So I will go ahead and bite the bullet and say I'm happy talking about market failure and appropriate ways to address it. With respect to experts, policy experts, I agree that there is danger in having policymakers, because policymakers can, as I point out, make mistakes. They have subject to the Hayekian knowledge problem. They can misuse government power for private ends, public choice concerns. So these are definitely problems. So what I think we ought to do is craft regulatory responses to market failures in a way that is sensitive to those problems, that acknowledges, okay, we've got a knowledge problem issue. We've got to make sure that the people making decisions here have the information they need. And when we look at the potential remedies for a market failure, some of them have less of a knowledge problem and create less public choice concern. We ought to select those particular remedies. So I agree with Ken that there are no all-wise and totally neutral government experts. I agree with that. I think we ought to craft policy knowing that that's the case. Finally, with respect to the issue of social welfare, so my book is very much sort of a welfarist approach, like let's come up with regulatory approaches that maximize social welfare. And Ken pointed out in his review, and I agree with him, that society is not a thing that exists apart from the individual members of society. So when I use the term social welfare, I just mean the policies that generally will lead to people living in that society having more happiness than they otherwise would have. I mean, I think we can say, you know, there's greater social welfare in the United States than there is in Venezuela. And it's not that there's a society of United States and society of Venezuela, but Americans have more wealth and typically more personal fulfillment than people living in the squalid conditions in Venezuela. So that's what I mean by social welfare. But my last point here is I'm not necessarily arguing for incremental change. I have no problem at all with fundamental change. I mean, I'm pretty thrilled about Brett Kavanaugh being nominated to the Supreme Court, because I think we will probably see some pretty major changes in the administrative state. It could happen, at least. And I think those are great and salutary developments. But even if we were to have a system where Congress fully writes the rule, it's implemented by the executive branch and the courts do nothing but adjudicate, we still need to have a sense of what is substantively a good rule. I mean, Congress is going to have to write that rule. And the ideas in my book further that end. So I don't actually see any tension here between what I'm doing and what I think Ken would like to do. And in fact, I would like to do it as well, which is restore us to a regulatory system that's more constitutionally constrained.
Well, one of the great benefits of working with Tom Lambert over the past many weeks to prepare for this program, and I think the listeners can hear this, is that discovery, at least a discovery on my part, that the differences in our approach are much more a matter of degree and emphasis than they are categorical. My problem with market failure, I guess two problems, is that the people, and not necessarily Professor Lambert, but the people who routinely refer to and rely on the concept of market failure to support their regulatory actions, undercredit the extent to which markets, in fact, are an extremely efficient mechanism by which to allocate resources. Again, these are a lot of people, not Professor Lambert. But I also have a problem with the use of the concept, because it sort of puts the goal line somewhere, or the start point somewhere down the field. By looking at a crisis like the 2008 financial crisis or some other economic crisis, and people say, well, there's a market failure and there must be a regulatory response, what that often ends up meaning or resulting in as a practical matter is simply additional and more complex and more expensive regulation because of the concept of market failure, you know, markets being sort of free markets as in absence of regulation. And so what we need are to close loopholes or close gaps in regulation. And we've all heard people say this. And when in fact, any market, certainly the financial system in 2008, and any other market that might fail, any other economic activity that might result in a suboptimal outcome now, today, in the 21st century, represents an unsatisfactory economic outcome in a legal context that is so heavily regulated. It's really a misnomer to start the discussion of the problems and what needs to be done to fix them with the concept, well, we've had a market failure. I would be happier if we would start every discussion after every financial crisis with a consensus recognition of the need to identify the regulatory failure that led to the undesired outcome. Experts, I guess I wouldn't say I'm a hardcore Hayek adherent, but I think that his work and writing on the use of knowledge in a society, the appropriate use of it, leads to, if you will, a constitutional conclusion, because he was quite clear that the knowledge of the circumstances of which, you know, governance systems must make use never exists effectively in a concentrated or integrated form possessed by a planner or a regulator, but they are in existence solely as the dispersed bits of incomplete and frequently contradictory knowledge which the separate individuals and the society possess. And this knowledge concept, again, and I'm talking about regulators and not so much Tom Lambert, but the knowledge, the significance of the knowledge, the dispersion of knowledge leads not to, I think, a conclusion or doesn't support a conclusion that the current regulatory systems need to be made more effective. They need to collect more data or have better or more complex modeling systems or upgrade their computer systems. No, it confirms the need to devolve power, not concentrate it with regulators, but devolve it to the regulated. And, you know, a system based on the rule of law with limited, mostly prescriptive rules passed by the Congress comes closer or moves closer toward that system. And likewise, social welfare, individuals are the best judge of their welfare, not a planner or a regulator.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article 1 initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.